by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, which does give some validation to this idea of the verse 9:15 being a kind of microchip for the whole chapter. And then you can understand it as I wasn't able to explain it in this way, but he does a better job than I, at least. Actually, I haven't read this before, but here it is. This is on 9:20, Chai Vidyamam Somapa Puttapapa. So that's when Krishna begins describing the Pratika Upasakas. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur kind of describes these three worshippers, Ahangraha Upasaka, Pratika Upasaka, and Vishwarupa Upasaka. And there he gives some statements which validate this idea. That means that verse 11 and 12 are about Mayavadis and represent the first one. The verses 16 to 19 represent the Vishwarupa Upasakas, the third group, and then the Pratika Upasakas, the second group, represented by the last 20 to 25. Okay, here it is. Only when there is some scent of bhakti in these three types of worship will the jiva begin worshipping me as Parameshwar, the Supreme. He will gradually give up the impurities of mixed worship and attain moksha in the form of my Shuddha Bhakti. If the worshipper abandons the false conceptions of oneness with Bhagavan, as in the Ahangraha Upasana process, he can gradually attain Shuddha Bhakti by properly deliberating on bhakti. The idea in the Pratika Upasana process that other devas are Bhagavan can also gradually culminate in realization of my Satchidananda Sarup of Shamasundar by deliberating on tattva in association of sadhus. The unsteady knowledge or worship of Paramatma in the process of Vishwarupa Upasana can also be removed by gradually realizing that the worship of my Sarup is the most elevated. The worshipper can thus can then concentrate on my human-like Satchidananda feature. So it describes how they can all come up to Shuddha Bhakti. But if a person who performs one of these types of worship persists in his attraction for karma and jnana, which is the symptom of his aversion to me, he cannot attain all auspicious bhakti. Because of their aversion to me, those who worship oneness, Ahangraha Upasakas, gradually fall into the network of illusory Mayavad reasoning. The particular Upasakas become bound by laws of karma described in the Rig, Sama, and Yajur Vedas. Having studied these three types of Vedic knowledge, which give instruction on karma, they become freed from sin by drinking the soma juice. They worship me by yajna and pray to attain swarga in the planets of the devas as a result of their pious deeds. Thus they attain the divine pleasure of the devas. So he's explaining how the first and second group can kind of sink down to respectively Mayavadis or those who just worship the demigods as described in that section of 20 to 25. So then he makes a very clear connection between those persons and those other sections of the Bhagavad Gita. So, and I kind of sensed that because it was just too coincidental, you know, that you have this verse that describes three kinds of people, and surrounding the verse are verses which talk about generally that thing. So it's those verses which are described, or surrounding verse 9:15, are describing when those people don't come up to bhakti, but they persist in their attraction to karma and jnana, and then they kind of, degenerate down to Mayavad and to which is jnana side, and then to the karma side, those who worship the demigods and go to Indraloka and so forth. So I thought you might find that interesting. So I humbly request that you don't throw out that idea completely. But perhaps, like I said, there are different levels of Mayavadis, Brahmavadis, and so forth. There's different kinds of people who worship demigods. And Krishna is describing them in a general way in 9:15. And he's warning those who are persisting in their attraction to karma and gyan to not persist, but to rather become attracted to him and come to Shuddha Bhakti. That's the whole purpose of chapter 9. Okay, so now we're going to begin chapter 13. And as you know, the chapter 12 is the last of the chapters dealing with Bhakti Yoga directly, and then the last six chapters dealing with Jnana Yoga mainly. So here it's like we're almost like starting a new book. It's quite different. All the, you know, the words have different meanings at different contexts. The whole approach is quite different. Chapter 13 is an outline, a format, or a matrix for the last six chapters. And it provides sutras that introduce these chapters. It's very, very philosophical. So at the end of the chapter, Prabhupada says, if you can understand this chapter with the help of a spiritual master, then you can understand the philosophy. Because, you know, the basic philosophy is given here. And this chapter is, like I said, it's like a, maybe you can say a sutra, or a group of sutras which represent the remaining six chapters. It's kind of setting an outline for the last six chapters. Baladeva Vidyabhushan writes, in the first 12 chapters, nature, the living entity, and the Lord were explained. Prakriti, I don't know, maybe Parameshwar, I don't know what words he used, and the live jiva. The same is explained here in more detail because knowledge is the gateway to devotion. Therefore, Kshatra and Kshatragya is explained in chapter 13. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says in his comment to this first verse, I offer my obeisances to Bhagavad Bhakti, a tinge of which is mercifully situated in processes such as jnana to make them successful. Bhakti Mishra Jnana is described in this third set of six chapters. Bhakti Mishra Jnana. So we're dealing with Jnana Yoga, which is with a little tinge of bhakti added, which is just enough to give you liberation. So it's called, this is what he calls it, Bhakti Mishra Jnana. So knowledge with some bhakti mixed in. Kevala Bhakti's supremacy is indirectly referred to in these chapters. Bhagavan is attained only by Kevala Bhakti. This is described in the middle six chapters. And the first six chapters briefly described how a Nishkam Karma Yogi attains moksha by Bhakti Mishra Jnana. Because the Nishkam Karma Yogi comes through the Jnana stage, and he comes to knowledge, and that little bit of bhakti mixed in, it can give him liberation. And if he's fortunate, he can be converted and become Yoginam Apisarvesham. Right. Okay, let's chant the verse and describe what's going on here. Arjuna vacha prakritim purusham chaiva kshatragyam evacha etam veditum mitchami jnanam kreyam chakeshava Sri Bhagavan vacha idam shariram kaunteya kshatram ityabhadhiyate etadyo vetitam prahu kshatragya ityadvidhaha. Arjuna said, my dear Krishna, I wish to know about Prakriti, Purusha, and the field, and the knower of the field, and of knowledge, and the object of knowledge. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, this body, O son of Kunti, is called the field. And one who knows his body is called the knower of the field. So Arjuna begins the chapter by asking about six terms. Prakriti Purusha, which are interrelated. Kshatra, Kshatragya, they're very much related. And Jnanam and Jnayam, which are related. Prakriti means material nature, and Purusha means the living entity. And Kshatra and Kshatragya. Kshatra means the field, and Kshatragya means knower of the field. And Jnana means knowledge, and Jnayam means the object of knowledge. These are very general, broad terms. Although, yes, Arjuna is not a great, you know, Vedantic pundit, but he's able to know at least this much terminology. And these are general terms, and some of which Krishna has already mentioned in previous chapters. Huh? 12, 10, 13? What?
What is the connection between chapter 12 and chapter 13?
Ah. Ah. Okay. Very good question. Was everybody thinking that same thing? I'm just waiting for you to ask. Well, you know, it was said in general, a general link, in text 8, Krishna said, Pesham aham samardharta mrityu samsara sagara. Yeah, for those who give up all their activities to me and devoted to me, then, for them, I am the swift deliverer from the ocean of birth and death. So now Krishna is giving knowledge which can deliver his devotees from the ocean of birth and death. And if you look back to our favorite verse, 12:12, Shreya hi jnanam abhyasat jnana jnana vashishyate jnana karma palat jagas jagas chanti anantanam. There Krishna said that if you cannot do this practice, then you should cultivate knowledge. And better than knowledge is meditation, and better than meditation is giving up the fruits of the work. So Arjuna, being very humble, thought that he should start right at the bottom. Just cultivate knowledge. So therefore, he humbly asks these questions. And in this way, he's following Krishna's last instruction. However, these links have not been given in any commentary by any acharya. They are just philosophical rumors that have been floating around the Vaishnava communities. So you may see some other links. You know, But those are two pretty substantial links, I would say. I looked, at least the versions, the scanty, broken English versions of the commentaries that I have, which are not so good, there was no mention of these ideas. Maybe they do exist, but I haven't really seen them. So Arjuna asks these questions, right? He wants to cultivate knowledge, obviously. And Krishna is very happy to give that knowledge because he wants to. As Baladeva Vidyabhushan said, that knowledge is a gateway to devotion. So this knowledge is there to help Krishna's devotee, Arjuna and others, actually get liberated from the three modes of nature and become more fixed in detachment, and so that they can concentrate on their bhakti to the Lord. So, please note that Krishna does not answer the questions in the order in which they're asked. But he jumps to the third and fourth questions and skips Prakriti and Purusha and leaves them for later. It's at the end of the chapter. Why does he do this? Well, in the process of philosophical analysis, which we will discuss later in chapter 14, we could say that it's a lot easier to first begin or describing the soul and the body and the difference. Because Prakriti and Purusha, as we will see later, is much more complicated. So it's better to begin with the simple ideas first, it seems. So Krishna says that idam shariram kaunteya kshetram ityabhidhiyat. It is said that the kshetra, the body is the field. And one who knows the field, he is the knower of the field. One who knows the body is the knower of the field, the kshetragya. So why is the body the field? What would you say? Why is the body the field?
Like in the field, the grass may grow, seed is grown. Similarly, in the body, it's because of the body, person acts. Action is performed and it can result in another body.
Yeah, right. Action and reaction. The seeds of desire and action of the fulfilling those desires in the body. They grow reactions. Any other ideas? Huh? In the field one can cultivate crops, he can also cultivate knowledge. Right? Also the field is the field of activities. The living entity, his body is his vehicle for all actions, right? So for him it's the field of activity. Any other ideas? Baladeva Vidyabhushan writes that it's called the field because happiness and the stress of the living entity grow in this field. The happiness and the stress which is tasted by the living entity grows in this body. So the body is the ground or field in which the tree of material existence grows. And we'll read something more about that in the next verse. Krishna says, idam shariram kaunteya kshetram iti abhidhiyate, that this body is called the kshetra. And then he says, etat yogati tam prahur. One who knows this body. So tat means that, and idam means this. Idam means something close to you. And etat is even closer than idam. So the body is very dear to us. It's very close to us. And Vishnath Chakravarti Thakur and Baladeva Vidyabhushan have different ideas of the consciousness of that kshetragya. Vishnath Chakravarti Thakur says that the kshetragya can be either a conditioned soul who identifies with his body, or the liberated soul who doesn't. But Baladeva Vidyabhushan has a more strict definition, and he says only the liberated soul can truly be called kshetragya. So there is some difference of opinion. A strict and more liberal definition of kshetragya. I haven't seen in any place where Prabhupada sides with one or the other. Maybe some of the students has caught a glimpse of some statements which may give us some idea. Usually Prabhupada sides with Baladeva Vidyabhushan, if there's any controversy, but here doesn't even mention this point, as far as I've seen. I could be mistaken, though. All right. Now, Prabhupada, at the end of the commentary, his purport, he writes a kind of summary of the six chapters of the whole book, really, up till now. In the first six chapters, the knower of the body, the living entity, and the position in which he can understand the Supreme Lord are described. In the middle six chapters of the Gita, the Supreme Lord and the relationship between the individual soul and the super soul in regard to devotional service are described. Superior position of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and the subordinate position of the individual soul are definitely defined in these chapters. The living entities are subordinate under all circumstances, but in their forgetfulness they are suffering. Can you think of some verse which describes that the living entity is subordinate to the Supreme Lord in the middle six chapters? Okay, that's one. Inchadvesa Samuntena Dvanda Mohana Bharata. Right. And what else? Oh, what about Daivyesha Gunamai? Right? The living entities surrendering to him. Jibya Gunamaya Bhavir. The living entities worshipping the Lord, offering him patram pushpam palam tvayam. Practically so many verses, right? Matam parantaram nanyat, supreme position of Krishna. The living entity, anywhere where the living entity is worshipping. Yeah. So many times. Oh, okay. So the living entities are subordinate under all circumstances. But in their forgetfulness, they are suffering. When enlightened by pious activities, they approach the Supreme Lord in different capacities, as the distressed, those in want of money, the inquisitive, and those in search of knowledge. That is also described. Now, starting with the 13th chapter, how the living entity comes in contact with material nature and how he is delivered by the Supreme Lord through different methods of karma, jnana, and bhakti. Although the living entity is completely different from the material body, he somehow becomes related. This is also explained. Oh, going back to the previous controversial contrast of ideas, Prabhupada says, the owner is distinctly kshatragya. Sometimes we think, I am happy, I am a man, I am a woman, I am a dog, a cat. These are bodily designations of the knower. So he seems to indicate that the knower of the body can be bewildered under the bodily concept here. It's like indirectly he's saying. Similarly, we can understand by little contemplation we are different from the body. I or you or anyone else who owns the body is called kshatragya. The knower of the field, the body is called kshatra. Okay. Krishna will continue answering. He answered the first question three. So far. Right? Three and four. Kshatra and Kshatragya. Now he gives some additional information in the next verse about Kshatragya, and he also gives a very brief definition of Jnana. Okay, let's chant. Kshatragyam chapimam vidhi sarva kshatrashu bharata kshatra kshatragya yur jnanam yattad jnanam atam mama. O sign of Bharat, you should understand that I am also the knower in all bodies, and to understand this body and its knower is called knowledge. That is my opinion. Of course, if he says you should, that I am also the knower in all bodies, doesn't mean that the living entity is the knower in all bodies, right? Because the English could be misconstrued, and that's explained in the commentary. You can see even the English, you can flip it around and twist the meaning, and what to speak of the Sanskrit. Because he said, kshatra mam chapi mam vidhi. Like Shankaracharya and other Mayavadis, they say, you should know that he who is the knower within the body is also me. That's the Shankarite explanation of this verse. Cha. That's how they interpret it. So you can have a lot of fun arguing with Mayavadis about this verse. But as Burjan very cleverly describes in this verse, he says, were that true, however, Krishna would be contradicting his own statements in chapter 15. Where he clearly makes distinctions between the soul and the supersoul. And he does that in this chapter too, later. If the soul and supersoul are factually one, as the Mayavadis claim, how could one aspect of the one, which is by definition undifferentiated, give knowledge to the other aspect of the one? How could the other aspect be lacking? How could something undifferentiated even possess an aspect? If both were one, absolutely no differentiation could exist. And Prabhupada also comments on the word cha in his commentary at the end of the purport. The word cha is significant, for it indicates the total number of bodies. That is the opinion of Srila Baladeva Vidyabhushan. Krishna is the Supersoul present in each and every body, apart from the individual soul. And Krishna explicitly says here that the Supersoul is the controller of both the field of activities and the finite enjoyer of the field. So the word cha seems to be quite important. It's mentioned by everybody. So watch out for that little word. Right? Just like the word also in this verse in the English. I am also the knower in all bodies. Just like the individual soul knows all bodies. Right? That's could be twisted out from the English. Okay. Vishnu Chakravarti comments. The body with senses is the facility for material contact and is called the field because it is the ground on which the tree of material existence grows. The jiva who knows his body, a jiva who knows the body is kshatragya, both in his conditioned state and his liberated state. Like a farmer, kshatragya is also the enjoyer of the fruits in his field, as described by the personality of Godhead in the Srimad Bhagavatam 11:12:23. And this verse is quoted by Prabhupada also, somewhere here. Let's refer to maybe. Village vultures eat one fruit of this tree, while the forest swans eat another. One who understands this tree of illusion, which has many forms, is the knower of the Vedas. So this verse is here in the Bhagavatam. 11:12:23. This is the Uddhava Gita. Here it is. 22 and 23. This tree of material existence has two seeds, hundreds of roots, three lower trunks, and five upper trunks. It produces five flavors and has 11 branches and a nest made by two birds. Guess who they are? The tree is covered by three types of bark, gives two fruits, and extends up to the sun. Those lusty after material enjoyment and dedicated to family life enjoy one of the tree's fruits, and the swan-like man in the renounced order of life enjoy the other fruit. One who, with the help of the bona fide gurus, can understand this tree to be a manifestation of the potency of the one supreme truth appearing in many forms, actually knows the meaning of the Vedic literature. Of course, there's many explanations of each aspect of the tree. We won't get into that now, but you can understand that this is like the harbinger or forerunner of chapter 15, where the banyan tree of the material existence is described in full. So it's already describing that right here from the beginning. In the field grows the tree of material existence. On the tree is the two kinds of fruits. There's three barks. There's this, that, so many things. So if you want to understand the whole thing, then you can read the Bhagavatam. 11, 12, 22, and 23. In the verse, well, make some comment on the verse, I guess, over here. We have the words hamsa, which means the swan, and also gridra, which means vulture. So the two kinds of men, right, vultures and swans. And it's obvious that the vultures, this word gridra means he grabs, he seizes the material enjoyment, sense enjoyment. That's his. So that is the nature of the conditioned soul. He's looking to seize sense gratification. So they eat the fruit of misery on the tree. Let's just finish at least the verse. Prabhupada gives a simple analogy here about the knower of all the fields as compared to the knower of the one field. A citizen may know everything about his patch of land. It's in the third paragraph at the end. But the king knows not only his palace, but all the properties possessed by the individual citizens. Similarly, one may be the proprietor of the body individually, but the Supreme Lord is the proprietor of all bodies. The king is the original proprietor of the kingdom, and the citizen is the secondary proprietor. Similarly, the Supreme Lord is the supreme proprietor of all bodies. Just like you may be a tenant renting an apartment, but there's the landlord. So anyway, you also care about the apartment, but the landlord cares about it even more than you, because he's the one who's going to have to take care of it for the next tenant, like this. And the landlord, he's managing and maintaining a whole group of apartments, whereas you're just maintaining your one apartment. So he has a more responsible position. So there's a difference. They both know the apartment. Right? They're both apartment knowers. But there's a superior apartment knower. That is the landlord. Prabhupada writes in the, middle of the fourth paragraph, after the verse, perfect knowledge of the constitution of the body, the constitution of the individual soul, and the constitution of the super soul is known in terms of Vedic literature as jnana. So Krishna gives a very brief description of what is knowledge. Someone who has knowledge of the field and the knower of the field, that's knowledge. Information, I guess you could say, of the field and knower of the field, that is knowledge. Kshatra, kshatra gayo, jnanam, yattas jnanam, matamama. That's my opinion. The understanding of the body and the knower of the body. We'll get to that. That's just a sutra, the other way. Then, Prabhupada gives even a more interesting analogy. One has to understand the position of Prakriti, Purusha, and Ishvara. One should not confuse the three in their different capacities. One should not confuse the painter, the painting, and the easel. No one else has given this. This is only Prabhupada vintage analogy. So which one is which? We have Ishvara, Prakriti, and Jiva, and we have painter, painting, and easel. Who is the painter? Okay, then what or who is the painting? Huh? Living entity. And or? Could it be? And the easel? Prakriti. Yeah.
Because the Prakriti kind of supports the living entity, right? The body supports the living entity, like the easel holds the painting. And plus, the painting is more kind of creative expression of the artist. The easel is just something you buy in the store, right? It's not like that. Even if the painter has created the easel, it's not the same amount of, you know, it's not as dear to him as the painting, right? That's a good understanding. So we have Ishvara as the painter, and Jiva is the painting, and Prakriti is the easel. This is the easel, right? This thing. Stand. Krishna Chakravarti Thakur comments, the jiva is kshatragya only of his individual kshatra, and knowledge of kshatra, and that knowledge of kshatra is also incomplete. I alone am the perfect and complete knower of all kshatras. Consider this my speciality. Consider this to be my speciality. So, Arjuna was thinking, what is jnana? So, anticipating that the Lord mentioned this, he gave a brief definition of it. Baladeva Nibhushan writes, the jiva is situated in his body just as a subject is situated under a king, even though he is kshatragya, and has knowledge of his own kshatra as a means of enjoyment and liberation. However, I alone am his controller and maintainer, and thus I am the perfect kshatragya, because I know all kshatras, thus I remain situated like a king. Thus Prabhupada gives the same thing about the king. Following Baladeva Nibhushan, as usual. Okay, now we'll go to next text. We have some questions so far? Yes? No, we'll see. Well, it depends on what you accept Krishna's identity is. Because if you accept that he's the Supreme Absolute Truth, then his opinion becomes an objective reality. It's not subjective in the sense of a conditioned soul. Right? Because that's the difference between subjective and objective. Subjective means it's a truth which could be only true for you, or at least only in your eyes. An objective means it's true for everyone. So if God says that he's the Supreme Absolute Truth, so then his subjective opinion becomes objective. It becomes absolute truth. But as we know, Krishna is also Lokavat Lila Kalvalyam, and he's playing Nara Lila, and like a human being, Manushim Tanamasrita. So he's expressing in such to Arjuna, also shows detachment, you know, so this is just my opinion on this, humility. And we see that Krishna will quote sadhu and shastra in the next verse to substantiate his opinion, to show that it's also the opinion of all the rishis and in the chandas of the Vedas. Which is proper. That's the proper way. You present your opinion and then you support it with sadhu and guru sadhu and shastra. Krishna here is acting as the guru, and then he quotes sadhu and shastra. And a couple verses to go. Yeah?
Yeah, the vulture just eats the fruit of misery, and the swans eat the fruit of happiness. Yeah, yeah. That's how it's presented here in the Bhagavatam. I mean, you can look at... why don't you read the commentary and then see it. Yeah, as far as I see, it's supposed to be the liberated soul of the swan. I think it was even translated like that's a great soul or something. Yeah. Swan-like men. Well, there's different kinds of happiness. And this is, I guess, the happiness of self-realization. Something like this. Anyway, I can't explain all the examples given in the Bhagavatam. I just present them to you. I'm just the peon carrying the message. I didn't write the message. I didn't write the Bhagavatam. So. Anything else? We'll go on. Yes?
I just want clarification about what you said, how English can be misread or misunderstood.
How what?
English, even English language can be misread.
Yeah. Yeah, but limit to the one kshetra. Right. I am also the knower in all bodies, as is the jiva. That's the twister. It could be misunderstood to say that here Krishna is saying that the jiva is also the knower of all bodies. Yeah, of course. But it's a sutra, so it can be flipped over and twisted a bit. I mean, that's my point, is that even English could be misunderstood, what to speak of the Sanskrit. And then Shankar's idea is also, again, another twist. That knower in the body, the knower in all bodies, that is also me. I am the Brahman. There's no individual jivas. It's all Brahman, and I am the Brahman, found in the bodies of all living entities. For us, it sounds so strange. It takes us a while to even grasp this idea. Okay, next verse.
Tat kshatram yadrik cha yad vikare yatasya cha yad sachayo yad pravavas cha tat samasena meshinu.
Now please hear my brief description of this field of activity and how it is constituted, what its changes are, whence it is produced, who that knower of the field of activities is, and what his influences are. So a lot of information is packed up there, huh? In a few words. So this is, again, is a sutra. This is also another kind of, microchip in this chapter. Here you have five different things. Yadrik, right, which means the constitution as it is, kind of, what it is, or as it's like. then vikari means the transformations. Yatash means where it comes from. Yo, which comes from the word yaha, when it's declined, means who that person is. And prabhavascha, yat prabhavascha, means what kind of influence that person has. Prabhav means power, influence. So you have five things. And Krishna says, tat samasena meshana. Please listen to my summary of these five things. Why a summary? Because it's unlimited, these things. And Krishna will give a brief summary now of these things. Actually, in this chapter, yadrik is described. Now, these are notes. I have to go back over these again, but this is what I wrote before. Yadrik is found in verses 6 and 7. The constitution of the kshetra. Then vikari, the transformations, are found in verse 7 and in verse 20. You might be able to add to this list. Yataha, from where it comes from, is given in text 6, text 21, 22, and 30. Yaha, who that person is given in text 14 to 18. And in text 23. Am I going too fast? Then prabhava, yat prabhavascha, the transfer or the influences are given in texts 14 to 18 also. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments, hear from me how this kshetra has different types of natures, desires, and transformations, such as enmity and friendship. Hear how it is born from the union of Prakriti and Purusha, and how it manifests differently in moving and non-moving forms. That is the jiva, and also Paramatma. Okay. So, Arjuna, well, actually it said that Krishna anticipated Arjuna's question. I guess it means he was thinking about this, and he was thinking, who has explained in detail the knowledge which you're about to summarize? Because he said, I'm going to summarize all this knowledge. So then Arjuna said, who has explained this knowledge? You know, like, where did you get it from? And Krishna answers in the next verse.
Rishibhir bahudha gītam chandubhir vividai prithak brahma sutra padaschaiva hetu madhir vinischitai.
That knowledge of the field of activities and the knower of activities is described by various sages in various Vedic writings. It is especially presented in Vedanta Sutra with all reasoning as to cause and effect. So here Krishna is referring to the rishis, various rishis, describe this in the different chandas of the Vedas. And it is described in the Brahma Sutra also. with all reasoning and logic as to cause and effect. So it's very significant that Krishna, who is the supreme authority, is quoting authority. Because it means that there's a standard procedure for presenting this knowledge. That means you have to, in spiritual circles, give some references and some pramanas. So here Krishna's describing that this verse, this information has been given by Rishibhi, by different sages. Bahudha Prit Gitam. They have sung it or described it in many ways. There he's describing Parashara Muni, according to Baladeva Vidyabhushan. He's referring to Parashara Muni, who is Vyasadeva's father, and who was himself Vyasadeva in his previous birth. And he, Prabhupada quotes from Parashara Muni's, from what I understand, he has something to do with writing the Vishnu Purana. So there it is. Prabhupada says, and Vyasadeva's father, Parashara, is also a great sage, and he writes in his books of religiosity, Aham Tvam Cha Tatanye. We, you, and the various other living entities are all transcendental. Although in material bodies we have fallen into the ways of the three modes, according to our karmas, as such, some are on higher and lower levels. The higher and lower natures exist due to ignorance and are being manifested in an infinite number of living entities. But the super soul, which is infallible, is uncontaminated by the three qualities and is transcendental. It's because that's just the sutra there. I, you, and the others. And there's some other, you know, descriptions, obviously, there. So Prabhupada says then again, and Parashara is considered principal amongst the rishis. So he mentions Parashara's name twice there. So that's who Krishna is referring to. But the other sages like Vishishta and so forth, Vishishta is mentioned by Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur in his commentary. He said that rishis like Vishishta and others have described this in their yoga sutras or yoga shastras. So Krishna is referring to Sarun Shastra, and thus he shows that Guru, Sarun Shastra are all necessary. So what would happen if you accepted only one of these three, say Shastra but not Sadhu or Guru but not Sarun Shastra, or Sadhu but not Guru and Shastra? What would happen if somebody accepted only one of these things? What could happen? So, you can discuss this in small groups for 5 minutes. Groups of 3, 4, or 5, however you want. Just for a few minutes, and make a list. Each group can choose one. Right? Say, the group here can discuss if there's only Shastra and not Guru. And this group here can describe if there's only Sadhu but not Guru and Shastra. And this group here, right there, you can describe if people accept only Guru but not Shastra and Sadhu. And the two back there, you can choose, however. You can break up into center. Okay? No guru and sadhu. what could happen, what misconceptions could go appear. No practical guidance. Yes. And it will become more difficult, or the difficulty will not go away. All right. The Shastra itself says you must approach a guru. So then you would not be following the Shastra if you didn't. Okay, that's good enough. Thank you. Next group. Good. Next group. Only sadhus.
No guru, no shastra.
Right, no shastra. No guru.
As no practical guidance from guru.
Okay.
And practical.
No guidance from the guru because you're not accepting the guru.
And now we are only sadhus, so there is no surrender as such. One can escape from all the things.
No one has to surrender to the guru. He can just be a cool sadhu, independent. He can make up his own path and there's no basis of knowledge. Right? Sahajiyas, Mayavadis, Panchupasanas.
By following so many sadhus, one will be confused completely.
Right, confusion will become very strong. Confusion will reign supreme. Okay. The continuous.
It's not that all the sadhus are there to guide us.
Uh-huh. The continuous guidance from the shastras will be lacking. And the inspiration from the shastras.
If there are no shastras, then proper dissemination of knowledge.
Knowledge will become fragmented and distorted. Alright. Good. Okay, next group. Guru and no Shastra and Sadhu.
First of all, the question is, why to select a guru? Because there is no Shastra and no Sadhu. So, why there is need to accept a guru?
He can reject the guru also. Reject everybody. Okay. Right, personality cult.
And also, guru can very easily interpret and exploit.
He can do whatever he wants, because there's no law book that he has to be checked. There's no way to check him.
And,
he becomes a loose cannon on the ship of absolute truth. A wild card in the deck of transcendental knowledge.
And also, different people have different gurus, there will be fights among themselves. My guru is superior, your guru is superior. There is no common basis to understand or live in harmony.
Right. Fragmentation and politics will increase amongst the sadhus and Vaishnavas. Intercommunal fighting. Yeah, good.
This is already happening because even in the presence of shastras, people don't accept them as they are.
Mm.
But even now, this is happening.
Right, to some degree.
All over the world.
Right.
India, especially.
Because people don't study the Shastras, or they may accept them but not study them, or they don't even accept them. Okay. Next group. Only Shastra. No way to resolve the contradictions or apparent contradictions. Many deviations will appear.
And Shastra cannot be understood without revelation by Guru.
Right.
Mercy of Guru. So there are no Guru, only Shastra you cannot have understood.
No mercy coming from the Guru or Sadhus to understand the Shastra. Yeah. Good. Thank you. Okay, last group? Or two more groups, huh?
Only Guru.
Guru, Guru, a Guru. Guru, Guru, and Guru. They'll accept the Guru as God because they have no criterion to judge. Once the Guru passes away or goes away, then everything is finished because it's all depending on him. It may. It definitely will. Fanaticism will reign supreme. Okay. Good. We added a few more there. Upper Sampradayas, yes. Yeah, I remember some story from this. What group was it? Ativadi? No, it was a different group. I can't remember. There was one guru that came naked to the wedding of one of his disciples and was jumping around naked, and then they said, "Oh my God, how can you come naked to my daughter's wedding? Get out!" And the guru said, "All right, you won't accept me, then I will never come back." And he walked away. And then the guy kind of got nervous, and he ran out the door of his house, and he ran down the street. Then he said, Guru Dev, please forgive me. I surrender to you." And brought him back into the house. And then after that, it was established that the guru can do any damn thing. There's no standard of behavior in that line. I forget what line that was. It was one of the 13 of December. That's interesting. Yeah. Okay. Last group. Anything left to add? I think we maybe did everything, huh? No guru, sadhu, or shastra. Nothing. Yeah.
Mm
So then you have a lot of different opinions. Because you can see that there's a great advantage having a line of sadhus who have given commentary on the Shastra, right, to explain it. For hundreds of, even thousands of years, right, you have commentaries. And then there's a whole tradition of explaining the various sutras and shlokas in the Vedas. Yeah. So many different opinions. Anything more? Yeah? I'll go in. Yeah. Right. You lose your faith in the Shastra because you can't figure out, you think there's so many contradictions. Another thing is that you don't know at what level to begin your practice. Your adhikar, you don't know because subjectively you can't say, and you have no guru to tell you at what level should you begin, at sakam, nishkam, ganamarg, or karma yoga, or bhakti yoga, or Pradhani Bhuti Bhakti, or right? Karma Mishra. Right? You don't have any idea at which to, if you're going to try to jump and become, you know, Nirapeksha Sadhu, right? Or Parinishta or Sanishta. So many different levels you can practice on. You can get really lost. And there's so many deities to worship. You can be very confused. Anything else? Okay, we did enough on this topic. Well, here's one shloka. Krishna saying, Rishabhir, Bahuda, Gita. Yeah, in Gaudiya Shastras, in Chaitanya Charitamrita, and Narottam Thakur has said this. I don't know, I can't recite that for you. Guru Saru Shastra Vakya. Something like that. This, in Prarthana and Prema Bhakti Chandrika, there's statements, clear statements. I'm sure in the Bhagavatam there must be also statements like that. Okay, maybe we can do some research, huh? Why don't all the students try to find some evidence, some pramanas to substantiate this point of Guru Sadhana and Shastra. Okay? Everybody try to look for some verses. Chaitanya Charitamrita, Bhagavatam. Or if you have some Brahma Sutra verses, or any Puranic verses, Vishnu Purana, Padma Purana. And of course we have this Yasya Devi Para Bhaktya Yata Deva Tata Guru. That's at least Guru is there. The Lord and the Guru. Right. That's from the Bhagavatam. Okay, you get the reference. Tomorrow we'll make a big list. That will be nice. For all of us, we can write down all these references then. Okay? Let's try to get 3-in-1. That's best. So, in the Brahma Sutras, Krishna's quoting
he says that it is established there according to nyaya or reasoning. Hetu madbi, cause and effect. It is explained there. So that is nyaya prasthan. We know there's shruti prasthan, smriti prasthan, and nyaya prasthan. So nyaya prasthan means there's logic and reasoning. So our process also establishes the supreme absolute truth with logic and reasoning. Just like, and Prabhupada stressed this quite a bit, because modern people, they need to hear logic and reasoning, because they don't have so much faith in Shastra, Guru, and Sadhu right now. So in the scientific process, you have hypothesis, experiment, then the results come, then analysis, then conclusion, and then other persons validate that by performing other experiments. So you have a very scientific process. So Krishna consciousness, the science of the soul, the science of bhakti, is also scientific. There's a certain hypothesis or a theory of philosophy. Then there's an experiment which you yourself perform. Then you get some result, then you analyze the result, and you draw a conclusion. And then other people practice that too, and then they, they validate and they consult. Like this, it's a very scientific thing that we're doing, actually. So we shouldn't be afraid of that or think that, you know, so if people like accuse us of being sentimentalists or, you know, sentimental religionists, and that they're the ones who are very, you know, logical and scientific, then we should give them, you know, this, some of these statements, that our process is also scientific, and also that they themselves tend to have blind faith in different theories and ideas which cannot be proven themselves. So they can be just as blind or even more blind than the religious people. What else here? Prabhupada quotes the Brahma Sutras at the last paragraph. He said they're nicely arranged of causing to cause and effect. Some of the sutras or aphorisms are 232, na vidya ashutehe. So that deals with the field of activities. That means the prakriti. Then 2318, natma shutehe. So that describes that the jivas are described as partial kshatragyas. And paratu tat shutehe, 2340. That is saying that Parabrahman is the complete kshatragya and is superior to the jivatma. So Prabhupada confirms that here we're talking about Prakriti, Jiva, and Ishwar. Now the last, and but not the least, is that Krishna has said that these things are just, he's giving a summary, and then these things are described in the chandas of the Vedas. So Prabhupada is quoting from the Taittiriya Upanishad, which is in the Yajurveda, if my memory serves me well. And he's confirming that, yes, it is true that there are more details given about this topic. And here,
there's the description of the Brahmaputcham Pratishtha, a manifestation of the Lord's energy. Here, he says, as stated before, Kshetra is the field of activities, and there are two kinds of Kshetragya, the Jiva and the Ishvara. Now he describes this Brahmaputcham. There's a manifestation of the Lord's energy known as Annamoy, dependence upon food for existence. This is a materialistic realization of the Supreme. Then in Pranamoy, after realizing the Supreme in food, one can realize the Absolute in the living symptoms or life forms. In Gyanamoy, realization extends beyond the living symptoms to the point of thinking, feeling, and willing. So these are all on the material platform, have to do with the conditioned souls. Then there's Brahman realization called Vijnanamoy, in which living entity's mind and life symptoms are distinguished from the living entity himself. The next and supreme stage is Anandamoy, realization of the all blissful nature. Thus there are five stages of Brahman realizations, which are called Brahmaputcham. Out of these, the first three involve the field of activities of the living entities, and transcendental to these fields is the Supreme Lord, who is Anandamaya. So there are two Vedic processes for understanding Supreme without descending knowledge, and this is kind of indirectly realizes these things and progresses in these two paths. One is called Yashti, and the other is called Samashti. And these terms are quite well known in the Vedas. Yashti means like microcosmic, and Samashti means macrocosmic. So here is being described in the second chapter of the Taittiriya Upanishad, the Yashti process, in which one focuses his meditation on the self to try to understand the Absolute Truth. And that was mentioned or described by Baladeva Vidyabhushan in the previous chapter also. And he was describing chapter 12, in the beginning of chapter 12, this meditating on Brahman. He was saying that it means meditating on the self. So this is kind of the Vyashti procedure. And one can get some understanding of the Supreme by meditating on the soul, since the Absolute Truth, or since the Jiva soul is a part and parcel of the Absolute Truth. Therefore, there can be some realization imparted by that process. Just like if you understand what is a drop of seawater, then you can understand what is the ocean. So although there's kind of maybe partial or indirect and relative realization of the Absolute Truth, still it is kind of a process given in the Vedas. And through that meditation, one can understand something about God. Now, the Samashti is when one meditates on the Visharup, on the material energy as part of God, or a manifestation of God. And this way they try to understand the Supreme. One would study the universe and consider it like God's body. This is given in the second canto of the Bhagavatam. Huh? Ekadvena, Pratakvena. Yeah, that's also, we're going back to those guys again. Yeah, the same. Ekadvena and Bahuda Vishuto Mukham. The Visharup Upasakas and the Ahangraho Upasakas. So, these are famous levels of, or what called koshas. They're like self-concepts or kinds of consciousness which cover the jiva. And as the jiva progresses, his consciousness will break through those koshas or sheaths covering, and he'll rise up to the highest anandamoya process. But these are all Brahman realization. So anandamoya, like a child, realizing, you know, seeing unity that everything can be eaten and not even distinguishing between if it's alive or dead. Right? That's the kind of vision of the absolute in everything. You know, everything that a child sees, you know, he puts it into his mouth, tries to chew on it. A book, you know, flowers, your hand. Right? So, and they don't distinguish between the living symptoms of themselves and others also. And that can be verified by psychotherapists and psychiatrists who describe the first 3 months of the child's existence and how the child thinks itself to be like the mother and is so completely dependent on the mother. Then gradually there's a distinction between the living entity, the child, and the mother. When the child realizes I'm different from my mother, I have my own feelings, I have my own pains and pleasures, and my mother's not here now like this, so then pranamoya comes in. And these are very early stages of the child also. You can see how they're present and in if you study the psychology of especially children, which is done today, it's prominent. Then you get Gyanamoya, when there's a thinking, feeling, and willing aspects are developed. That's considered quite high for modern society. A person has to be fairly elevated nowadays to come to that level. Most of society is only comes up to the pranamoya level, when there's the unification or the unified idea is that of, you know, struggling to survive. Especially in the cities, everyone feels a kind of unity. Yes, we're all here struggling to survive in life, working and getting food, and that's usually what people talk about, you know, their struggle to exist in the world. And then quite elevated would be thinking, feeling, and willing. When the person is, I don't know, maybe more thoughtful and not denying certain feelings, more in touch with his feelings, and analyzes and reflects upon things and acts only after thinking and feeling about something, like this is considered somewhat developed human being. That's called Gyanamoya. So the person has some knowledge. However, Ramanujacharya says that in order to actually be situated on Gyanamoya, one has to be fixed in Varnashram Dharma and Vedic knowledge, because Gyanamoya means full of knowledge. So the knowledge should be coming from the Vedas. So at least the person should be practicing on religion or human life on that level. Gyanamoya. So these are still like on the material level. But then Vijnanamoya means when there's some differentiation between the life symptoms and, or, you know, the body and the soul. When thinking, feeling, willing, and the soul itself, the living entity. So then the person's not so much, because there's differentiation. The unification is therefore seen in the soul, seeing that everyone is part and parcel of the Supreme Absolute Truth, Brahman. Brahman realization. So the Brahman realizations are on a lower level. Actually, Brahma, as we'll see later, can be understood to be the material energy. Mahatattva or Pradhan is also called Brahma. Mahat Brahma, Krishna says. So on the material platforms, the Brahma realization is Anamoya, Pranamoya, and Gyanamoya. And then Vijnanamoya, it comes up higher above the mental and emotional transformations. And then Anandamoya means the blissful nature of the Absolute. But this does, as far as I understand, it doesn't, it's not talking about Ananya Bhakti, but simply they accept the personal feature of the Supreme Lord and they worship that, and therefore there's some Ananda there. I'd have to do more research, but I've heard it explained that such persons on the Anandamoya level, they come up to these higher levels of the universe, like Satyaloka, Tapaloka, and so forth, Janaloka, Mahaloka. So these are simultaneously subjective layers or self-concepts of the soul, and they're also actually energies of God, objective forms of Brahma, or the Lord's energy. And the example is given as, just like people in a country, they consider themselves to be citizens, as you consider yourselves to be Indians. Or I may consider myself to be an American, even though I haven't lived there for 25 years, but it helps to break the self-concept, right, if you don't live in your country for a long time. But usual, okay, we won't say you, but, you know, people in Pune, generally they consider themselves to be Indian citizens. So it's their subjective view. But it also is objectively true that they are Indian citizens, and then there are certain rules and regulations set for people to live in India. And if you follow those rules, you can stay here and live here. But the dogs and the monkeys, you know, and the birds, they're also Indian citizens. But they don't think of themselves as Indians, right? But they actually living here. So, but their consciousness isn't developed enough to have this subjective view. But objectively, they are, you know, citizens of the state. So anyway, you can see how both the subjective and the objective views can exist simultaneously. So that is the Brahmaputra, these five levels described in the Upanishads. And here, so this is some of the things which is being described by Krishna, or being referred to by Krishna here in this verse. Yes. What is called?
Manomaya.
Oh, Manomaya. Yeah, yeah. The jnana is also called Manomaya sometimes. Yeah, same thing. Because there's thinking, feeling, and willing. Okay, last two verses, then we'll finish.
Mahabhutanyahamtaro buddhir avyaktamevacha indriyani dashaikam cha pancha chandriya gocharaha
Ichha dvesha sukham dhukham sanghatas chetanajidhi etat kshetram samasena savikaram udharitam.
The five great elements, false ego, intelligence, the unmanifested, the ten senses and the mind, the five sense objects, desire, hatred, happiness, desire, the aggregate, the life symptoms and conviction, all these are considered in summary to be the field of activities and its interactions. So here's a breakdown of this field, the kshetra. Right? Etat kshetram samasena, it says. So here's a brief, again, it's a summary of the kshetra and the vikaras, which we describe in text 5. The vikaras are described here in text 7 of the kshetra, or the kshatragya, or when they're together, at least. So, Mahabhutani Ahankaro, that's six things, right? The five Mahabhutas, earth, water, fire, air, ether, and then Ahankara, so that's six things. Second line, Buddhi Avyakta Mevacha, two things, the Buddhi and the Avyakta. The unmanifest. The unmanifest, well, I think it's sometimes, here it's mentioned to be pradhan. So actually the pradhan is first. So buddhi here is actually kind of listed in an opposite order, because avyaktam, from avyaktam comes ahankara and then buddhi. So it's not really in the exact order in which it appears at the time of creation. So the avyaktam is the first thing that manifests. Then indriyani daishai kamcha. So you have 11 senses. You have panch karmendriya and panch gyanendriya and the mind. So that's 11. And then panch chandra gochara, you have five objects of the senses, touch, form, taste, smell, and what is it called? Texture, I guess. When you touch something, it's texture. Touch, form, taste, smell, and texture. Sound, touch, form. Oh, yeah, touches. Sound, form, aroma, taste, and texture. Okay. So there, so far, you have 24. Right? 6, 2, 11, and 5. Right? First line has 6, then the second line has 2, third line has 11, then the last line has 5. So there you have 24. So that's the kshatra. And that is the yadrik, or the constitution of the kshatra. Then you have the six functions or qualities of the mind, which is derived from interaction with the 24 elements. Because, you know, the soul has two bodies, gross and subtle. Right? So we have this other field with transformations and psychological movements, feelings, emotions, conviction, hatred, friendship, enemy, da da da, this and that, all going on the mental platform. So that's another whole verse just for those things. Icha, desire, dvesha, hatred or envy, sukham, dukkham, happiness and distress, sanghatas, that means the aggregate, that refers to the body. Right, the aggregate. Where is that? Did I write it? It means the body as a result of the five mahabhutas. Prabhupada also says the aggregate of these 24 elements is called the field of activity. That means the body. Then you have chetana, which means living symptoms, but it refers to the consciousness which is reflected in the heart, or a state of mind in the form of knowledge. So it's not talking about the soul, but it's talking about the consciousness which is reflected in the heart. And the person is still conditioned, then he has a conditioned consciousness, contaminated consciousness. Okay? Therefore, these are all within the realm of kshatra, or the material field. And then dhriti means determination. So that's also a mental state. So etat kshatram samasena. These are the kshatra in summary. And the savikaram udaritam. And the transformations. So you have six qualities of the mind, and the six qualities of the mind plus the sangatas, the sangata, which makes seven more items, which are listed in text 7. Seven items in text 7, 24 items are listed in text 6. Okay? So icha, dvesha, sukha, dukkham, chetana, and dhriti are the six functions of the mind. Or they're the transformations of the kshatra on the subtle plane, you can say. And then you have the sangata, which makes the seventh item. Sangata is the aggregate, which means the body, which is composed of the mahabhutas, earth, water, fire, air, and ether. So these are all within the realm of kshatra. Prabhupada writes, the living symptoms, or chaitana, represented by consciousness and conviction, are the manifestations of the subtle body, mind, and ego and intelligence. These subtle elements are included within the field of activity. So dhriti and chaitana, it's not to do with the soul, it has to do with the mind. The unmanifested modes of material nature, the avyakta is called pradhan, the unmanifest. So he says in the last paragraph, this body, the body is the representation of all these factors, and there are changes of the body, which are six in number. The body is born, grows, stays, produces byproducts, and it begins to decay, and at last vanishes. Therefore, the field is a non-permanent material thing. However, the kshatragya, the knower of the field, its proprietor is different. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur describes that in the Shrutis it is said that the functions of the mind are desire, determination, doubt, faith, lack of faith, forbearance, detachment, shyness, intellect, and fear. These functions exhibit the qualities of kshatra. So he's quoting from the Shrutis, which substantiates Krishna's statements. So here is the Yadrik and the Vikara of the Kshatra, which was foretold in text 5. Text 4. Text 4. Yadrik and the Vikara. Yataha? Oh yeah, Yataha also is in text 6. Because it describes it comes from the Avyakta and the Mahabhutas. You can see how, I mean, Krishna's just, you know, on the battlefield in the chariot and he's giving a lecture. And you can see how it's coming out, right? It's not just some ordinary discussion. Rather, it's very, very scientific. And as I said, these are all like sutras for the whole rest of the book. So it's everything's compressed in sutra form in this chapter. And later we'll see verse 22 is like the Mahavakya of this chapter, and it is referred to back again and again and again by Krishna in the subsequent chapters, in the chapters that follow this one. Krishna will refer again and again and again to this verse, Prakriti, Purusha. What is it? Purusha Prakriti Stohi Bhunkte Prakriti Jandana. Sarasat. You and me? Yes. So. Okay. So, any last questions before we break? Yes. The aggregate. No, it's not. I said there's six functions of the mind plus the aggregate. The aggregate is something different. Yeah, the subtle body. Oh, yeah. Well, that's transformations of the gross body, but there's also transformations of the subtle body. So he's mentioning some other transformations. The other transformations are, he says, about, it's in the first paragraph he describes, about the subtle body. He says, then there's desire, hatred, happiness, distress, which are interactions representation of the five great elements in the gross body. Representations of the five great elements. I don't know. I don't understand how they're representations of the Mahabhutas, but that statement's a little bit over my head. I mean, I understand, and the other commentators have mentioned, and it seems clear that these are transformations of the subtle body, because the gross body doesn't get happy or sad or, you know, desire, or doesn't get envious of someone else's body. That's the going on the inside. Anything else? Yes, in the back?
Yes,
Well, the false ego can be also purified. I mean, if the it depends if the pure devotee is nitya siddha, then there was no ever any contamination, right? So then the body is not a manifestation of the false ego, but it's just created by, you know, lila shakti, by the Lord's yoga maya potency, and then he takes a gross body, but it's not based on false ego. And any kind of ego that he, false ego that he does express, is just because of yoga maya. Just like when the Uttam Adhikari drops to the Madhyam level, that's also yoga maya. But if the pure devotee is a sadhan siddha, that means that his false ego has become purified along with the intelligence and the mind. And therefore, the gross body, which was once a manifestation of the false ego, is no longer such, because there's no false ego. But he still has the gross body. So, in either case, in the second case, in the sadhan siddha, or the sadhaka, his false ego is purified, so then he's using the body in the service of God, so then the body itself becomes purified just as you put an iron rod in the fire. So although it's iron, it acts like fire. And if you say, I don't believe it, then I'll say, touch it. Right? So the body, which appears to be gross material matter, actually is acting as spirit. So the whole quality of his existence is transformed. So in both cases, you have a very unique situation, which is not usual. And therefore, the statement that the gross body is a manifestation of false ego doesn't apply to the pure devotee of the Lord. Yeah. I mean, you can trace everything back to the soul, but icha is coming from the mind. Because I think you can obviously, you know, observe that a lot of desires are not coming from your soul. Isn't it? Can you say that every desire you have comes from your soul? No. A lot of it's coming from the mind, and from the samskaras and, you know, prarabdha and aparabdha karmas which are attacking the subtle body. You know, so desire originally, you can root it and trace it back to the soul, but that is just anandamaya vyasa. The soul wants to be happy. But the soul makes the wrong choice, ends up in the material field, and then is covered by the subtle body, which means the mind. Basically. And then the mind comes up with all of these things because it's material energy and it's affected by all of the previous samskaras from millions of lifetimes. We have a whole collection of feelings, desires, impressions, and so forth, which are all recorded in the mind. And so those things pop up and then those desires come in from the mind. So the vikaras of the subtle body, of the kshetra, the subtle aspect of the kshetra. That's how the living entity enjoys, you know, happiness and distress in this body, mainly through the mind. The body is just the gross vehicle. If there was no mind, you wouldn't be able to enjoy the senses of the body. Any other points? Okay, we'll stop then. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki.